The talk today is called Wild Dirt. And it's a talk that's partly inspired by the piece of paper that's been on the notice board the last few days. I think it's in the old instructions pocket now. But it's called The Four Brahma Viharas. And the language talks about four incredible states of mind that are kind of endless, vast, unlimited resting places. And the paper gives us some sentences that might help us practice those, practice an entrance into that state, so that we could then experience the true state spontaneously, more easily. And it also gives us some language about what I would call today like the family, the family of each of those four states of mind. But it's talking about the enemies of those states of mind. I would like to call it the family today. So with friendliness, the number one, the one that usually gets all of the press, I would like to also call it friendliness and not love today. So friendliness is said to have a far enemy and a near enemy. And I would like to call it like maybe two relatives. And just experiment with it and see what happens. If a relative of friendliness is hatred, and if a relative of friendliness, a close relative of friendliness, what they call a near enemy, what looks so much like friendliness that we could easily be mistaken to think it is friendliness, a close relative. Desire is the word they use. So I want to talk about it as family instead of enemy. Here's another one. Here it comes. From the other inspiration of this, the other main inspiration of this talk from what's called Jinshin Jutsu, which I've only mentioned very casually so far on this retreat, I think. And that's where I said, notice where your hands are, and that your hands could be here or here or like this. So that comes from a Japanese art called Jinshin Jutsu. Jin is human being, shin is God or spirit or heart. Jutsu is, we could say, art or technique, trick. I think literally it's closer to trick. Tricks for human spirit, heart, whatever. With the art of Jinshin Jutsu, we only need to apply a technique when there's some disharmony. It's not that we always need to go around holding the thumb or whatever. And even when there's disharmony and we feel like holding the thumb, or we notice that we're biting the thumb or whatever, something in us wants to hold the thumb, we can just hold it. We could, what they say in Jinshin is listen for the harmony. So we can take disharmony as a reminder to listen for the deeper harmony, for the unexpected harmony. For the harmony that doesn't go according to my wish, but is harmony. The harmony that, like, travels me beyond me. And so this is partly why the talk is called Wild Dirt. Things that we think of as dirt. It could get our attention and think, oh God, I'm so dirty, I've got to get clean. Or it could just be a reminder to wait a second. This is certainly from the earth, and it certainly is on my clothes. And it smells good. Because what we usually do when we see my clothes are dirty, I have dirt on my clothes, or on my face, or whatever. In the name of cleanliness, in the name of getting clean, getting it right, getting to harmony, we do the equivalent of smearing ourselves with shit, if I may say so. And then, oh, look how clean I am. Now you can't see the dirt because it's covered with shit. In our hatred of the idea of dirt, we do crazy things. So the third inspiration for this talk is the real inspiration for the talk, for me at least, which is about wildness and how to recover our wildness. Usually, our idea of wildness has to do with some compulsive behavior. We say someone's really wild when they do some really predictable reaction. When they're really reactive, we say they're really wild. And so I'd like to start at the bottom of the list of the Brahmaviharas, which is usually that boring old equanimity that comes last. Because no one has much to say about it. And I also don't have much to say about it, but we don't feel usually that inspired when we think of equanimity. But the possibility that kind of spreads through our whole being when we think of non-reactivity, our possibility to not be reactive, even if someone else is reacting all over us or whatever. And the cool thing about feeling into these different qualities as families, so equanimity is usually said to have a near enemy of indifference, which means we try to be equanimous by ignoring life, by putting on a kind of veil that we, as so that we don't care, we try not to care. But what if indifference isn't a near enemy? It is a false equanimity, but what if it's still in the family of indifference? So what if it's a reaction to caring? And what if it holds in it the possibility of non-reactivity? So even if I find myself feeling indifferent or trying to feel indifferent, even if I notice that this is another kind of dirt, or that this was the shit I rubbed on top of the dirt, all is still well. It's still a good sign. We're always looking for good and bad signs, but what if it's all good signs? And it's all written with dirt. So just think of some times where you felt yourself to be, or you felt someone else to be, non-reactive, and what was possible then. Feel in yourself the possibility to relate to others, not through the masks of emotional charge, or in other words, our preference. Then something sometimes can like spring that is wild. It's not a compulsion. It's not stupid trying to look smart. Then they're done that. The whole weight of reactivity, when it has fallen away and what has been possible, what if we can call upon that even when there's reactivity? And even through the reactivity to feel, to use a reactivity, a reaction, a compulsive action. Or non-action. To meet the relative non-reactivity. So that's all I want to say about non-reactivity. Don't want to give it too much excitement suddenly. But I had said last time that I might continue with the quotation from Krishnamurti, so I'll just bring in the middle part that I skipped last time. So we had the heart entering the mind, and then the mind kind of realizing itself as limitless, able to think in any kind of freely, so non-reactively. So exactly, there's not limits put into what we could think, and there's not limits put into the efficiency of what thought could come through in the simplicity of meditation. It includes the practical as well as the seemingly unpractical. And also the sense of living in a vast space where we are part of everything. So then Krishnamurti continues saying, meditation is the movement of love. And this is also where maybe this number four on the list ties back to number one on the list, the friendliness. But when there's non-reactivity, then there is it's possible for love to move. Then there simply is a movement of love. When there is reactivity, we have no way of knowing what is meant by the movement of love. Because movement for us in our experience would be reactivity. And it would be in reaction to. And love, even though we think of loving others, love is not in reaction to. And we think of movement as something limited. We only bother to move and be busy, sort of, when we're not quiet. And then when we know quietness, non-reactivity, then we know what he means by movement. Meditation is the movement of love. It isn't the love of the one or the many. So it's not a reaction to anything. It doesn't need something to inspire it to be. But again, in a way, we're still talking in the wake of equanimity, of non-reactivity here. We haven't gotten to friendliness. Maybe I prefer to call metta or maitri friendliness, because I think all of the four are about love. The friendliness, the compassion, the joy, and the non-reactivity. So meditation is the movement of love, not the love of the one or the many. It is like water that anyone can drink out of any jar, whether golden or earthenware. This is again this concept of family, which I can go into a little bit more about the Jinshin families of experience. No matter what is happening, no matter what our experience, whether our experience is golden or whether our experience is dirt, and I want to point out that gold is also dirt. We just happen to think gold is worth fighting over and showing off or whatever. But I'll just continue the quotation first. So he's speaking of meditation as the movement of love, as water that we can drink out of any jar. So whether we think we're clean or dirty, we can drink out of our experience, meditation. It is inexhaustible. And a strange thing takes place, which no drug or self-hypnosis can bring about. It is as though the mind enters itself. So we had the heart entering the mind. And now he's saying, don't worry, we have time to digest this. We have years to digest this. The mind, it is as though the mind enters itself, beginning at the surface and penetrating ever more deeply, until depth and height have lost their meaning and every form of measurement ceases. Yes, I can. I was going to apologize for those. I carried this quotation with me for years, and you may have heard it before. But so it is as though, beyond any drug experience or anything we could imagine ourselves into, it is as though the mind enters itself. Don't worry about that phrase if it doesn't hit you right away. Beginning at the surface and penetrating ever more deeply, until depth and height have lost their meaning and every form of measurement ceases, ends. In this state, there is complete peace, not contentment, which has come about through gratification, but a peace that has order, beauty, and intensity. And so we come up the list of the four Brahmaviharas from the responsiveness. Why should we call it something negative? The responsiveness of equanimity. To joy. And in between here, I want to speak about this wildness that we need to recover, that we have, and the trickiness of our recovering it through methods and through trying our best and through our best intentions. it's staying true to that wildness that springs into life when we're tuned into not only reactivity. So that's the responsiveness, the equanimity. And what helps us, so Krishnamurti says, there's peace, but it's not just, again, it's not just like an indifference. There's order, beauty, and intensity. So it's not the kind of order, it's much more intricate, much more complexly woven, weaving itself, than any order that we could think of. There's a sense of things falling into place. There's a sense of even the mind having its place, having its job, and not needing to be drawn towards what's not its job. In responsiveness, where we allow a real thought to come through that's beyond what we would have expected and brings together the practical and the spiritual so gracefully, taking care of our needs and others' needs without any separation. Just, oh, right. So that kind of order, that's one expression of that order. And here comes joy and intensity. Sorry, here comes beauty and intensity with the joy. Mudita. Joy is our guidance. It is our guide. It is the leading edge. So we do need to look through the so-called near enemy of joy, which we can say is excitement. But not as an enemy. So it's in the family of joy is excitement. One of the relatives of joy. We could say, this is my experiment of the day. This is, you won't find this in a Buddhist text, I don't think. But I think that they would agree now terms in now language. If we can look through excitement, it would be like really meeting someone's eyes. And it doesn't matter if they have any game going on, that they're trying to impress us or get rid of us or get us to like them or whatever. We can look through the game and still meet the person. And we can look through our own game and still be met. So if we look through the game of excitement, we look through the eyes into the depth. What is the excitement about, for example? And not to get too psychological, but it can help to give one example, which could be there. We notice there's excitement, and instead of saying, oh God, that's the enemy, let's kill it or run away as our only options. We could say, you're the relative of my friend Joy that I need to meet today because I need some guidance. Could you help me find joy? And even if excitement doesn't listen, doesn't seem to listen, if we feel right through the eyes to the feet of excitement, feeling our own feet and feeling the feet of excitement, just as we can do with another person when we're meeting through some kind of haze of persona. Thank you. we might notice that there's excitement about an idea of getting somewhere, for example. And we could notice that the excitement is actually taking us away from what the idea means. So that the movement is away from, the movement is hypocritical. The movement says, I love going deeper, I love peace. I'm so excited, there's peace. It's going away from what it says it wants. But maybe in the feet of excitement, there is a true wish for peace. And we can just go right down to the feet and together bring excitement along to joy. Because joy knows peace very well. Joy knows the way. And joy for fun will not tell us the way, except for now. It won't tell us tomorrow what's going to happen. That's what joy is that we get to have this discovery. We don't get to have that story of I know where I'm going and I know what I'm doing and let me tell you about it. So juiciness could be another way of saying. But in our inner experience, joy is something that we can absorb and be absorbed into, but we can't catch it. So just to be aware. It's not something to try to catch. When trying to catch goes on, that's fine, but don't take it too seriously. Don't let it get in the way of the joy itself and the following joy, the willingness to be led by that lightness. It's good to absorb ourselves into joy when it comes. It's good to even go looking for joy, knowing I can't catch it. So if you know you love in the night after the last thing on the schedule to listen to those sounds, whatever they are, I don't know what they are, but they're so sweet. If that resonates with some leadership in you, that is a leading edge that you don't know where it goes. So not the leader that's promising we're going to go here. Just come along. I have some candy for you. But the leading edge that has the kind of confidence to lead all of our being, pain and suffering as well as happiness and peace, top to bottom, body to spirit, whatever. It unhesitatingly leads. And there's something in us that would unhesitatingly follow. And if we could let that pull us along, head last, instead of head first. We do get turned inside out, of course, by the way. It's not only a promise of, like, glory superheroism or whatever. But yes, you will be turned inside out. It won't be so pretty all the time. And it will be joyful, even when it's sometimes painful. Not in a masochistic way. Not because of the idea that suffering is good for me. But a deeper, it feels, I don't know why this language comes to me a lot these days, but as if in our system that something so deeply is in love with that following or that process, even to the extent of being turned inside out, even when it hurts, it happens to hurt. It's not like because it hurts, I'm happy. But it happens to hurt along the way, and something else is more joyful and interesting than that symptom and its fascination. The symptom stays secondary, and we attend to it if needed, kind of thing. It's also not like to ignore the symptom, trying to focus on the joy of transformation. But letting that efficiency and limitlessness that could be in the mind when we're quiet help us take care of our symptoms along the way too. Does that make any sense? I feel a little bit like I'm speaking a foreign language. Is there any question? I should say it that way.
That's the far enemy of joy.
I think I'm going to, because I have a long way to go in a short time, I want to leave that on the board. It's envy, but anyway. And actually, it's a good question because it totally fits with this ceasing of every form of measurement. Height and depth have lost their meaning. That's like the doorway. As we let joy lead us, we leave behind the competition. No. It's true. It's a phrase in English that we say, you leave the competition behind, meaning like you're the fastest one. Which, in English, sorry, there's a phrase that you could say, like race cars. If you leave the competition behind, then you're the fastest race car, which is not at all what I meant, but there's a way that it could be. It's also true that there's a swiftness, but it's not about the others. And isn't it lovely that the, let's say, distant relative of joy is envy, or let's call it competitiveness. So when we're feeling competitive, we might know that we're in the household of joy. Joy may be nearby. If we could honestly meet competitiveness, like notice, this is competitiveness. And what is this experience? Meet it. Find its feet. What is it truly, what is its true wish? To leave the competition behind. The whole game of competition, not the others. As if the others were the competition. There's one other aspect with joy, now that we bring in this, thank you, Kaleshji. We bring in the others into the house of joy. Just the simple information about ourselves that we still tend to think of intimacy with others as coming mostly from sharing the difficulty. And if I say the most terrible thing that ever happened to me, then we feel that we're really close. And if I say to you, even though many times people will say with the hand over their mouth, the most wonderful thing that ever happened to them, we don't think of it as such an intimacy, even though it really is. We don't acknowledge that intimacy. So the intimacy of, shall we call it juiciness instead of joy? Or lightness? Or leaving the competition behind. Where depth and height have lost their meaning and every form of measurement ceases. Krishnamurti is calling it complete peace with order, beauty, and intensity. So we already have the order, beauty, and intensity from the non-reactivity and the lightness or juiciness of the leadership of joy. And we still have two households. So it's curious that these are called the Brahma Viharas, because Vihar is a name for a monastery also. They use for a monastery, the Burmese Vihar, the first place that I lived in India, in Bodh Gaya. The Burmese household in Bodh Gaya. With this most amazing old Burmese guy who'd lived in India for so long. He was like the grandpa of all of the community. I don't know if he's still there. He was deciding whether to retire last time I was there years ago. He would be sitting there smoking his little hand-rolled cigarette in the dark by the entrance with his dog. And people would come with everything, every kind of story, every kind of trick, every kind of need, and he would just sit there and do what needed to be done. So this responsiveness. And sometimes he was impossible to understand. He spoke English and Hindi, but he was almost impossible to understand. So much of the time I would get him to tell stories sometimes, and I would miss half the story, but it was, the whole point of the story was to see his laugh. His face just light up and his little kind of brown teeth to show. So he's a good example of the possibility of karuna, which I think if we could just decide we're not going to understand karuna today, we're just going to open the subject of what is it and not understand it for a while. It's usually translated as compassion, which is, feels like nearly completely missing the mark. We could almost say compassion is another near relative disguising itself as karuna. What I could say about Burmese Bhante, the head of this monastery in Bodh Gaya for decades, that may be somewhere in what karuna is. Was sitting there by the gate in the dark with the mosquitoes and no supper because he was a monk. No matter what came through the gate, like no matter what, because I know like a lot of things that came through the gate, and I know I don't know half of it, from like mafia to police, which is another kind of mafia, at least here. To the life stories of people who used to be called the untouchables that were working in his ashram, in his monastery. There would be like not a blink of the eye. Like so much not a hesitation about whether he could meet the person or whether he could run away from the story. Just, he was there. And he could still tell a funny story the same day. So what I like about him as an example of karuna is that bad news is nothing special. It doesn't make someone special. It doesn't mean that there's a right to demand anything special. It doesn't mean that there's a need for specially to avoid the person. Like, bad news is just something that happens every day. And so is good news. And if we want an excuse to meet, both are equally good, and also no excuse is good.
Isn't that equanimity, though?
I feel in the difference between the non-reactivity of equanimity and this unflinching meeting of compassion, that there's the meeting in karuna. There is meeting. Whereas the non-reactivity feels more like almost the plate for everything else, the space in which it all, everything else could happen. But I'm hoping that at the end of this, all the four households end up being the same thing. Like I said, love. So let's see if we can feel without words, if words don't help us, the quality difference between what might be karuna and what might be non-reactivity. To me, the equanimity, the non-reactivity, or responsive, the springiness, responsivity, responsiveness, kind of has no ground in a good way. And with karuna, it feels like there's more ground, also in a good way.
What?
Ground. Well, we could call it heart, but I didn't want to say that word. It's like there's a space where we can meet. There's a ground that we can meet. So the near enemy, near relative of karuna is pity. So this is easy to talk about because this is what we usually actually experience and call compassion. Where we have an addiction to doing good. To the extent that sometimes there's somewhere in us that's glad when there's bad news, because then we have a job. Part of this ground of the heart that I feel may be, again, we're probably not talking really about karuna. We probably won't get to the point of it today, but where I feel there's more ground, or ground of the heart, or ground for meeting in karuna than in the just pure wildness of responsiveness. Comes this sentence, we've all done everything, which I think comes from the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, where they think of many, like just uncountable lifetimes. And they literally understand this. It's not just like to help us accept kind of theoretically in some abstract way. There's like this literalness to the statement that can be good to play with, without turning to the subject of past lives. Just what if in some way or other, whether mentally or physically or emotionally, we've all done everything. There's one other aspect that I want to bring into the subject of karuna, where there's meeting ground in the heart. Not the heart with any emotional tone at all. Simply as a meeting ground. is just the subject of our authority or empowerment. So one reason that we might be glad when there's bad news, because then we know we should do something, and we try to do what we think we're supposed to do, and we feel involved and helpful. We have the idea that we're doing good, and that relaxes us somewhere. That's one addiction that takes many, it can take a long time to detox from. Where we're motivated purely by the idea of doing good, as necessarily in and of itself, no matter what, a good idea. Even when we know how confused our ideas of what good is are, we're still willing to be motivated that way. So that's one part of it. And then it ties into our, let's say, disempowerment inwardly. And that's why we want to have a job, or why we want to feel useful, or want to be doing, want to be active. So with pity, with this poor relative of Karuna, we see something pitiable, pitiful, and it's a response that pretends to care and pulls away at the same time. It reaches towards and moves away at the same time. The reaching towards of saying, poor you, is the movement away. The movement away is the poor you. And the only really good way I found to really accept how much pity goes on in us is if you have ever been on the other side of the poor you, which you may have been, but you might not have noticed. If you've noticed yourself being a poor you to others or another, and how unhelpful that is, except in the way, so here's where it's a relative of compassion, a good, kind relative, very, a lot of strength, that relative. If we are being pitied, if we are in a pitiable situation, does everyone know the word pity? First of all, pity? Probably pity?
I know what it is, but I don't know the translation.
Pitié.
Yes,
probably. There's the belief, the idea that whatever has happened to me, or whatever I have done, or whatever has happened, is sort of off the charts. It's so bad that everyone wants separation from it, from me. I am the bad news. I am in the newspaper for something terrible that's happened. Whether it's literally in the newspaper or not, maybe in the gossip rounds or whatever. So if we could really tenderly feel in ourselves how we would love to tell that story about someone else. Oh, poor so-and-so. Out of love, I want to let you know that so-and-so had such and such. Whoa. Just don't believe it. If you have to do it, but don't believe yourself. It could be that the news must be told, but let's see how tenderly we can feel that wish to tell it as an empowerment of me. And there's something of that in this way of where our sense of deep connection is in sharing the negative. There's something of that as well. Even if I'm sharing my bad news, it's like it includes a kind of demand that we meet deeply, or it includes a kind of pretension of deep. So I'm not at all trying to say to erase the value of speaking about those difficult things. It can be the most important event in someone's life to be able to say that thing that did happen that I haven't said for 20 years or whatever. Or don't wait 20 years. You don't have to.
It can be sometimes an act of liberation.
Yes. It can be an act of liberation. And then we can also be very careful to feel what else may be uncovered in another situation of telling that or another thing. So one possibility with karuna may be, and this is another differentiation from the just simple responsiveness, general responsiveness of upekkha, of equanimity, is that there may be a way of catching a situation catching a difficult situation of ours, of our own. Try it on yourself first and then deal with others. A difficult situation that's happening to me, that I could catch it in a way, like without taking just the idea of it, but the whole thing with all of its aliveness and potential, so that aliveness of the dirt, and where it has a direction in it, when I catch that situation without pity, without trying to get away from it, without thinking that it takes me out of the human race, but right into it, and for everyone, without being a superhero, without any gap, even when others think they have a gap from me because they haven't been so bad off. Catching the situation with its direction and letting that direction and oomph. It gives oomph to the way that the lightness of joy leads us.
Can you translate oomph? No, I'm kidding.
Power. We're talking about power. I'm just trying not to use those words. Or I'm not trying not to use them. They're not coming because then we go to ideas. Yes, ma'am?
Don't catch a situation, but sometimes we turn.
Or let the situation also land.
Yes, but sometimes we don't have even this place of...
Yes, we do. We do. We do. We feel in the difficult situation that we have nothing, we have no resources, we have nowhere to go, we have no strength. And therefore, some other power in the situation, in me, can meet and turn it into a direction that is for the common wealth, common good. And so just briefly to say that we do know, we have seen it, we have seen ourselves and others, where there's a difficult situation and it goes sour, and there's a difficult situation, it could be the same or more difficult. Sometimes it's easier when it's more difficult because we're less aware of having any chance to win. We've given up the chance of winning, and so something can happen, a different kind of power. It's exactly by having nothing. But that even having nothing, whether it's literally living on the street or any emotional street, that we find another empowerment. And it's not that there's any wish for repetition. Like, we don't go back and do the same thing again to get it. It's got the freshness, the wild, it's the wild dirt. Okay. Okay, so we leave the star of friendliness for another time. And I'll end with this poem called Rice. This is by Mary Oliver. It grew in the black mud. It grew under the tiger's orange paws. Its stems thinner than candles and as straight. Its leaves like the feathers of egrets. Those are those beautiful white birds that are often in the rice fields. Its leaves like the feathers of egrets, but green. The grains cresting, wanting to burst. Oh, blood of the tiger. I don't want you just to sit down at the table. I don't want you just to eat and be content. I want you to walk out into the fields where the water is shining and the rice has risen. I want you to stand there far from the white tablecloth. I want you to fill your hands with the mud like a blessing. Thank you for listening. May all beings be happy. May our lives be fulfilled and contribute in a real way to the liberation of all.